Well, brethren, what is the meaning of the next 7 days? We must learn to live God's way. We must get it right in order that we may teach it the right way. If there is anything I would like you to take away from this sermon today is this. If we cannot live under God's laws ourselves, how will we ever be able to teach to others? And that's really why we're here these 7 days. We are getting a foretaste of the millennium, where God's law will be the only law. We heard last night Mr. Pippi repeat what Mr. Armstrong used to ask. And Mr. Armstrong would ask, "Why are we here?" But after he finished the sermon, I'd like a little play on the words. Why we are here. And he would emphasize that. Let's look at a few scriptures where it is commanded for us to be here. If we would, turn to Leviticus chapter 23. And beginning in verse 1. "And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel, and say to them, The feast of the Eternal, which you shall proclaim, holy convocations, even these are my appointed feasts." If we turn over back to Exodus chapter 23, beginning in verse 16. And Exodus chapter 23, beginning in verse 16, we read, "Also, the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors which you have sown in the field. Also, the feast of ingathering in the end of the year when you have gathered in your labors out of the field." In Deuteronomy 16 and 13, "You shall keep the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days after you have gathered in your grain floor and your wine press. And you shall keep the feast." You shall. Some of you may know that I used to be a state trooper. For 16 years I worked for the state of Texas. And we had a manual. And in this manual we called it the Bible. Now, Bible just means book. But in this book, the first paragraph said, "Shall or will be considered a direct order." And here God says, "You shall keep the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days after you have gathered in your grain floor and your wine press." So this is a direct order from God Himself. There are some in the scattered church today that think the feast is 8 days. It's not. It's 7, just like it says in the scripture. The 8th day is completely and totally separate feast day. What Mr. Armstrong says about these days, in the plan of God, the sermon that he gave in 1980 in September, I quote, "We are here to celebrate and to receive a foretaste of something that is coming that the world doesn't know is coming to this world. And that is an absolute utopia." Don't laugh when I say utopia, because I mean utopia. Look in the dictionary for the word utopia. And it's an imaginary fool's dream about a perfect civilization with a perfect government, with a perfect society, with perfect education, with everybody economically well off and everybody having a perfect time in every way. Brethren, that is what is coming to this world and coming soon. And we're here to enjoy a foretaste of it, and we're here to prepare ourselves to help usher it in and to be in the government of Jesus Christ, when he will rule and govern the entire world. End of quote. In Jeremiah chapter 31, beginning in verse 7, and in Jeremiah chapter 31, beginning in verse 7, we read, "For so says the Eternal, sing with gladness of Jacob, and shout among the chief of the nations. Cry out, give praise, and say, O Eternal, save your people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I will bring them from the north country, and gather them from the corners of the earth, and with them the blind and the lame, the woman with child, and she who is in labor with child. Together, a great company shall return there. They shall come with weeping and with prayers. I will lead them, and I will cause them to walk by the rivers of waters in a straight way. They shall not stumble in it, for I am a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn. Hear the word of the Eternal, O nations, and declare it in the coastlands afar off, and say, He who scatters Israel will gather him and keep him as a shepherd keeps his flock. For the Eternal has redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of the stronger than he. Therefore, they shall come and sing in the heights of Zion and shall flow together to the goodness of the Eternal for wheat and for wine and for oil and for the sons of the flock and herd. And their soul shall be as a watered garden, and they shall not pine away any more at all." In Isaiah chapter 11, and beginning in verse 11, in Isaiah chapter 11, we read, "And it shall be in that day." And in that day means what's coming in the millennium. "The Eternal shall reign, shall again set his hand the second time to recover the remnant of his people that remains from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathos and from Ethiopia and from Persia and from Sinar and from Hamath and from the coast of the sea. And he shall lift up a banner for the nations and shall gather the outcasts of Israel and together the scattered ones of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Assyria will no longer be the aggressor. They will actually be helping Israel, carrying their children." We read of that in Isaiah chapter 49. So in Isaiah chapter 49, beginning in verse 22, "So says the Eternal, Behold, I will lift up my hand to the nations and have set up my banner to the people. And they shall bring your sons in their bosom, and your daughters shall be carried on their shoulders. And the kings shall be your nursing fathers, and the queens your nurses. They shall bow to you, face to the earth, and lick up the dust of your feet, and you shall know that I am the Eternal, by whom they shall not be ashamed, who wait for me." Many years ago, I was required to go to a shack, when I worked for the state. It was one room. In the corner of the room was the bathroom, and there were two little children there, 1 5, 1 2, blonde-headed, blue-eyed, prettiest children you'd ever seen. I had to rescue them, along with the child protective people, and I had to put down newspaper in the back of the car to put them in the car, because they were so filthy. And I took them to my home with the people that worked for the welfare department. And we had put them in the shower and actually had to cut their clothing off of them. And one of the ladies that worked for the welfare department went into town and bought clothes. And the other one prepared a meal. It was just something simple like bean wings and tea and maybe some coleslaw or something like that. And just, and the little five-year-old boy looked up at me and he said, is it always going to be like this at your house? I was tough in those days. I'm not so tough. But I want us to think about those Israelites that will be coming back from captivity. They will not be as stiff-necked. And I can attest to that with my neck. They will have been broken. They will have been changed. They will be ready to be taught. It's a time when the whole world will eventually be called. We are just the first fruits of this great harvest. The feast will be the great gathering and gathering of the whole world. In Zechariah 2, beginning in verse 11, in Zechariah chapter 2, in verse 11, and many nations shall be joined to the Eternal in that day, and shall be my people. And I will dwell in your midst, and you shall know the Eternal of hosts has sent me to you. This will be a time that God's people will have to assume their duties to begin teaching God's law, the law that we are to be learning now. A well-known scripture in Revelation chapter 20, a verse that we're very familiar with, Revelation chapter 20, beginning in verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and who had not worshipped the beast nor his image, nor had received his mark in their forehead, nor in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. God's government will eventually be spread over the entire earth. During this time, it will start in Jerusalem. It will go from Jerusalem throughout Judea, from Judea to Samaria, from Samaria to Israel, from Israel to the entire world. It's like a mustard seed. God begins very small. He actually began with just one man, a man named Abraham. And I look out here and I see the product. We always go back to the two trees. There's no discussing God's plan without going back to the two trees. God's plan is so simple, and yet the world makes it so complicated. Man has been given but two choices. Adam and Eve chose wrong and condemned the entire world to living without God. When Adam sinned, God set his plan in motion, a 7,000-year master plan, and we are now observing the time that represents the last phase of that great plan. God has a blueprint for what he is working out here below with humanity. The holy days are a blueprint of God's for God's people to follow. They tell us exactly what God's plan is and how he is working it out, beginning with Passover, the days of unleavened bread, Pentecost, trumpets, atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles, and the last great day. The millennium is definitely toward the end of that blueprint. In Deuteronomy 16 and 16, which was read at the offertory. In Deuteronomy 16 and 16, he says, three times a year shall all of your males appear before the Eternal, your God, in the place which he has chosen, in the Feast of Unleavened Bread, in the Feast of Weeks, and in the Feast of Tabernacles. And they shall not, there's that shell in there again, they shall not appear before the Eternal empty. Well, we've all obeyed that this morning. In Deuteronomy 14 and verse 22, we read, you shall truly tithe. There's that word shall again. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year. And you shall eat before the Eternal your God in the place which he shall choose to place his name there. And brethren, we have a millennial setting here. What a beautiful setting this is. I live in a big city where there are bright lights all the time. And here it gets dark when it gets dark. And I'm used to rain that comes sideways, not straight down. And if we were in Israel, we would be considered being blessed by this rain, because rain is a sign of a blessing. And he continues on in verse 23, the tithe of your grain, of your wine, and of your oil, and the firstborn of your herds and of your flock, so that you may learn to fear. You shall learn to fear the Eternal, your God, always. And if the way be is too long for you, so that you are not able to carry it, or if your God, or the place is too far from which the Eternal, your God, has chose to set his name there, then the Eternal, your God, when the Eternal God has blessed you, when you shall turn it into silver, then you shall turn it into silver and bind the silver in your hand, and shall go to the place which the Eternal your God has chosen. And you shall pay that silver whatever your soul desires, for oxen or sheep or for wine or for strong drink or for whatever your soul desires, and you shall eat there before the Eternal your God, and you shall rejoice. We're commanded, you shall rejoice, you and your household. In the book of Nehemiah, chapter 8, beginning in verse 17. And in Nehemiah, chapter 8, beginning in verse 17, we read, and all the congregation of those who had come out of the captivity made booths and sat under the booths. For since the days of Joshua the son of Nun until that day, the sons of Israel had not done so, and there was very great gladness. So here Israel was keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, and they were commanded to be joyful with very great gladness. Booths or tents represent temporary dwellings. These are condominiums out here. They're our temporary dwellings. And I must say, I've been to other feast sites that weren't quite as nice as what we dwell in here. I've been in feast in third world countries. We have brethren today that are having the feast in not so nice of conditions. In 2 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 13, our bodies can be likened unto tents as well, temporary dwellings. In 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 13, but I think it is right, as long as I am in this tabernacle, to stir you up by a reminder, knowing that the putting off of my tabernacle is soon, as indeed our Eternal Jesus Christ made clear to me. In the Good News of August 1980, in an article titled, But why temporary dwellings? A tent will sooner or later be folded up and put away. Is that how you think of your physical body? Too many people don't think so. They fret and worry about the shape of their nose, the color of their hair, the wrinkles that comes with increases of age. They spend their lives in anxious pursuit of more luxurious ways to pamper, clothe, and shelter, and transport these temporary dwellings. They miss the point entirely. They don't know what this life is all about because they don't understand that we are merely pilgrims preparing for an eternal inheritance. Step out into the eternity for a minute and look back on this life. Does it really matter that you can't afford to feed and clothe your body as you would like? That you have flat feet, a bad back, or that your tent is defective in some other way? Maybe even with a serious terminal disease. Your tent was not designed to last forever. It was only meant to last long enough to get you to your inheritance when God will give you an eternal house. Continuing in Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 15, God continues on. He says, 7 days shall you keep a solemn feast unto the Lord, your God, in the place which the Eternal shall choose, because the Eternal your God shall bless you in all your increase, in all your works of your hands. Therefore, you shall utterly rejoice. Webster's Dictionary defines joy as to feel joy or great delight, to give joy, to gladden. How will things change in the millennium? Well, basically, in civilization, you have things like government, education, you have business. You have business and industry. You have science and technology. You have all these various facets of civilization. But in this world, we've used them wrong. I started out with government, but I realized that I needed to go back to education first because I feel that's probably the most important. You have to be educated. No one can really live a happy and productive life without the right education. In Proverbs 22 and verse 6, it says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart. Many of us here, old enough to have children, that have departed from God's way. They've gone back into the world. But brethren, sometimes I think we worry too much. We think that God's not doing enough to get them back in His church. Of course, we would all like that to occur. I'm a living example of that. My mother came in the church when I was 13 years old. And I was brought up. I used to go to Big Sandy to the old Redwood building when that was all that was there. And in those days, you sat there in the Redwood building and you looked straight ahead, because if you looked a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right, you were getting out of line. There was no YES. There was no YOU. And so I thought, well, as soon as I get old enough, I'm out of here, which that's what happened. I didn't want people telling me what to do, so I joined the Army. But I made a lot of foolish mistakes. But over the period of time, You know, God doesn't forget his people. He doesn't forget us. We've trained that child in the way that they should go. I've got a daughter that's gone into the world. But, you know, I have to realize that God loves her far more than I do. And he hasn't forgot her. And he hasn't forgot your children or your grandchildren or anyone else. I'm reminded of what Mr. Gerald Waterhouse said to a woman one time. She came up to him and said, you know, so-and-so's doing this and so-and-so's doing that. And this is what's happening over here. And he said, you know what I do about that? He said, I go pray about it. He said, because no telling what God's liable to do when he finds out. And that's the way God is. Sometimes we get a little bit over-anxious about our children. But, you know, they're in God's hands. They may have to learn some lessons. I did. I went into the U.S. Army, and they told me what to do. And for 16 years, I worked for the state of Texas. And they never called me for good things. They only called me for bad things. And I've seen enough of this world. I've seen enough of this suffering that goes on. I have people that ask me, I just can't picture you doing that or being tough and rough and wearing a .357 Magnum on your hip and driving that car and going after these outlaws and busting down doors in the middle of the night and drug raids, etc. And I laugh and I think, well, maybe it's because I'm being a little converted now. Hopefully that's true. But in Proverbs chapter 1, beginning in verse 7, we read, "The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." And over in Psalms chapter 19, beginning in verse 1, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the expanse proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to reveal knowledge." Skipping down to verse 7, "The law of the Eternal is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Eternal is sure, making the simple wise." I remember my captain one time came to me and he said, "Stephen," he said, "not only do you not know anything, you don't even suspect anything." He was absolutely right. And in verse 8, "The precepts of the Eternal are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandments of the Eternal are pure, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Eternal is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Eternal are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired than gold, even much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey, the honeycomb. And your servant is warned by them. In keeping them, there is great reward." You know, science and technology is awesome today. Mankind seems to abuse and misuse everything he invents. The iPhone is a wonderful tool. You can communicate with it anywhere in the world. It has a GPS calculator, music, internet, and a multitude of applications that do everything you can imagine. But it's turning people into zombies because they walk around with their head down and they're not praying. They're walking around with their little iPhone. And it's taken away of a lot of ability to communicate. Since I've had my neck broken, I've had a little bit of experience with the medical field. Medicine has really become a god to so many people. The whole industry is built around trying to circumvent God's penalty for physical sin. The doctors spend years learning a specialty, but know almost nothing about actually keeping people healthy. And in the military part of technology, everything the military develops is to further the cause of war. Billions of dollars are spent preparing for war, having the war, cleaning up after the war, preparing for war again, over and over again, building up stockpiles, then billions of dollars are spent waging war. I had the opportunity several times to spend the feast in Tucson, and they have a boneyard, they call it, outside the Air Force base there in Tucson, and there are literally thousands upon thousands upon thousands of military warplanes that are absolutely useless, that this country has spent not billions but trillions of dollars on, and they're worthless. They're all cocooned up in case we might need them. While we're here at the feast, sometimes we like to speculate on what the millennium will be like. God tells us what He's going to do, but He doesn't tell us exactly how He's going to do it. Some of us think that there are going to be flying cars. Some people think that there's only going to be horse-drawn carriages. I don't know, but it's interesting to speculate on. How about the agriculture? The power of a nation resides in its ability to produce food. My brother, who graduated A&M University, magna cum laude, and he had a degree in agriculture, and he taught, was a professor at college teaching agriculture, and in his old pickup truck, he just looks like an old farmer, and he has a bumper on his bumper sticker on the back of his pickup truck that says, "If you eat, you're involved in agriculture." And I was thinking today that as soon as this sermon's over, we're going to be involved in agriculture, and I plan on doing a lot of plowing. In the 1950s, I was able to be raised on a farm and ranch out in West Texas. And Mr. Armstrong wrote the book, United States and Britain in Prophecy, and had the pictures there of grain being dumped in the middle of the streets because we produce so much. I've actually seen that. I was part of that. We would produce so much wheat and grain that the trains and various transportation couldn't haul it off fast enough, so we had to dump it in the middle of the streets. Of corn and wheat, and I saw that. But that's all been taken away now. Today, farmers can barely keep their heads above water. I know of a family that has 5,000 acres. That's a lot of land. But they have to borrow money year for year to put their crop in. They borrow their money for their tractors and other equipment and are constantly in debt to the bank, to where the bank now runs the farm. They tell him what he's going to do on his own farm. It's a constant struggle for farmers today because that blessing has been taken away from Manasseh. And they're in constant fear that the bank is going to come in someday and say, "You don't no longer own this farm. It belongs to the bank." In Haggai chapter 1, and beginning in verse 6, we read, "You have sown much and bring in little. You eat but you do not have enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You dress, but no one is warm. And he who hires out himself, hires himself for a bag full of holes. Well, that's a pretty good definition to me of inflation. It's interesting that my stepfather, in 1960, and to me that hasn't been that long ago, with $100,000, bought 1,200 acres, two homes, seven barns, two huge lakes stocked with all kinds of fish, and a forest 90 miles north of Big Sandy for $100,000. And today, if you went down and bought the greatest pickup that you could buy with the diesel engine and four doors and four-wheel drive and all the bells and whistles, as they say in the car business, you'd pay around $85,000 for that. Which would you rather have? I know what I'd rather have, because that pickup is going to deteriorate in 5 years. The millennium will be a dramatic change from the way man does things. In Amos chapter 9, verse 13, and in Amos chapter 9, verse 13, we read, "Behold, the day comes. The days come, says the Eternal, and that the plowman and the reaper shall draw near, the treader of grapes, who draws along the seed, and the mountains will drip sweet wine, and the hills will be dissolved." There will be agricultural prosperity in the millennium. There will be rain in due season. That's what humanity can look forward to, is absolute perfect weather conditions to grow crops. How about economics in the world tomorrow? In the world today, it's quite complicated. Man makes everything in our society so complicated. The economic system is one of them. A person should not have to go to school and major in economics to understand the economy of your country. But today, I don't understand economics. I don't understand derivatives or selling short or futures or the economic terms that they use today to manipulate economics. How many people here really fully understand the stock market? How many people take advantage of the stock market? There's a deep corruption and manipulation of these economic systems that we have. Even when they go to school to learn economics, they go to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, the other colleges of higher learning, they learn economic systems, but it seems like none of them work. The banking system is confusing as well. The banks are able by law to loan out more money than they actually have. If you put in $1 to a bank, they can loan out $10. I don't understand that economics, but, and it's interesting to me that if you go to the bank, say, and you borrow enough money to buy 100 acres, say, and you get a 10-year note on this property, and for 9 years, 11 months, you make those payments just every month you make those payments. But that last month, you have a little hiccup in your job and you can't make that final payment. Do the banks say, well, you've paid for 99 acres here, we're going to give you the 99 acres, and we'll keep the 1 acre for the, what you owe? Or do they get the old enchilada, as they would say in Mexico? No, the banks foreclose on the entire 100 acres. I think that's a little unfair. And what's interesting in the United States, the Federal Reserve is a misleading name. It's a private company. You can find it under Federal Express or wherever. It's a name that's meant to confuse us, and I'm not going to go into it, but people think it's actually a government entity, and it's not. It's a private holding. And our Constitution of the United States says that only Congress can do that, can make money. But we've turned it over to a private entity, and they can do it however they want to. Our entire system runs on greed and the desire for power and control. But we're here to celebrate that those days are numbered. We just celebrated Atonement, which is the day of Jubilee, we heard last Atonement, to where the Jubilee will be sounded and everyone that were made a mistake, perhaps, in their economics and had to lease out their land. But that's all they're going to be able to do is just lease it out. It's going to go back to them. These bankers are going to be pulling their hair out in the millennium. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10, and in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10 we read, "For the love of money is a root of all evil, of which some, having lusted after, they were seduced from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." You know, it's interesting when you want to get people's attention when you're giving a sermon, you can say sex, you know, but against, you know, pay attention, or demons, you know, people begin to take a little more attention, or you can say money, 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 and you can get people's attention that way. I've always said, just follow the money. Just follow the money. But what does God say in Proverbs 30? In Proverbs chapter 30 and beginning in verse 8, I'm breaking the middle of the verse here. God says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me." Be satisfied, what he's saying. Here's what you have. How many people would say that, especially in our get society today? How about the tax system that we have? I'm sure Britain's tax system is just as confusing as ours, just as complicated. I'm tickled by it. I've been to the Middle East now 4 times. And while there, when I was in Jordan, or in a Arab area of Israel, they would have these homes, but on the top of the homes they would have the rebar of steel sticking from the corners of the homes. And I asked a man there, I said, "Why are these homes, you know, they look like they're just partly built?" He said, "Oh, they're finished with their home." He said, "What they do is they leave that rebar up because they have a system here that you don't pay taxes on the home until you're finished with it. And so they leave all that up, you know, and it's kind of like a Texas term that we use. We're fixing to do this, we're fixing to do that. Well, we're fixing to add on someday, maybe, kind of, sort of, to this home." So they don't pay taxes on their home, and that's the reason they do that. That's the reason that rebar is sticking up, because if the tax man comes around, they say, "Oh, no, we're not finished yet. We're fixing to put on another addition to the house." So they don't pay tax on the house, and that's the way they get by with it. And in continuing in Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 10, God says, and your barns will be filled with plenty, and your presses shall burst with new wine. There's going to be an abundance, brethren, like there's never been before on the face of the earth. You know what? The tax system that God has, we all understand that God only requires 10% to run everything in the world tomorrow. And when you add a third tithe into that, that's to take care of the widows and orphans. God has laws for taking care of the poor as well. In Leviticus chapter 23, beginning in verse 22, "And when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not completely reap the corner of your field. When you reap the gleaning of your harvest, you shall not gather. You shall leave them to the poor and to the stranger. I am the Eternal, your God." Today, our idea is just to send them a welfare check or give them a card that says you can go to the grocery store and get your groceries for free. But God says you got to get out there and glean the field. If you want to eat, you're going to get out there and you're going to glean. But you're required to leave the corners unharvested. I know that my grandfather told me the story out in West Texas of during the 30s, during the Depression. And it's very sad. We had beautiful herds of Hereford cattle and dairy cattle. And I remember one man my grandfather was telling me about, that they dug this deep pit with a bulldozer and run the most beautiful cattle you ever saw, dairy cattle, in this pit, and then took Winchesters and shot them all and covered them up. That was man's way of handling the Depression, or part of the way of dumping whole milk when the rest of the world was starving to death. They were paying farmers now not to plant. And I remember what was interesting, a story that happened to us out in West Texas. We had irrigation out there, and the government came along and says, "You're producing so much grains, wheat, corn, sorghums, that we just can't build silos big enough to keep it all. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll pay you, if you just plant half your crop, just plant half your crop, and we'll pay you like you farmed the entire farm. But just leave it fallow, and we'll pay you double." And the old West Texas farmers, they were not too dumb. They thought, we got irrigation, we got fertilizer. So they double-rowed everything. They raised twice as much on that one half as they did in the government, saying, "How is this? We're getting ourselves in worse trouble all the time with these people." How about the environment of today? Mankind is quite simply poisoning and ruining everything he touches. I think Mr. Armstrong said besmirching. I like that word. From the land to the oceans, we're killing the fish and other sea creatures with all the plastic and pollution. We heard Mr. Henderson talk about the plastics in the ocean here a few sermons ago. We have an island of plastic and debris twice the size of Texas, Mr. Pippi. Twice the size of Texas. Now, brethren, I come from a big state. It's over 1,000 miles from El Paso to Texarkana, Texas. And it's over 1,000 miles from up on the Panhandle down to Brownsville, Texas. It's over 1,000 miles. Texas is a big place. There are areas in the Pacific Ocean that are twice that size, full of plastic and other debris that are deteriorating and getting into the fish, which we are consuming. And that's floating around the ocean now. How about our forests that are on fire, destroying thousands of acres and trees, as well as houses and property in California? How about the ones, I didn't know that they had those kind of fires in Greece and in Australia, as I understand. What's really amazing is when society decides there's a problem and they insist the government do something. And the government usually does something, but which makes it much worse. Forest fires are a good example, like in California. Environmentalists got upset about the forest and lobbied the government to do something about it. And they would come along and say, well, this little creature here that lives in the forest, you can't go in and harvest the trees or the underbrush or anything because of this little creature. You have to leave it alone. As a result, the logging industry is nearly dead, with putting thousands of people out of work. And their great idea of leaving nature untouched has led to far worse forest fires than we've ever had. There's a very simple scripture at the very beginning of the Bible that could have instructed men about how to take care of the world that he was given in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15, we read, and the eternal God took the man and put him in the garden of Eden to dress and to keep it. To dress and to keep it. Adam had something to do to dress and keep it. I think the same thing could be said of our forests and our natural resources. There's a God's way of keeping and dressing and keeping these problems from happening. Another thing is our society that we live in. Each culture seems like it that has a society. And people have lost the ability to really communicate with each other. There was a news story a few weeks ago that showed that young people today are more comfortable talking to someone online than in person. Again, as a state trooper, I had to learn to size up people pretty quick. When I walked up to them, I had to understand by their body language and by their words, is this going to be a good situation or is this going to be a bad situation? Well, I've learned that over the period of time. But today, people don't have that ability because you text and there's no emotion in their voice, in their eyes, in their demeanor. And you can tell a lot about a person. Just by, we brethren, my wife and I have had a long dry spell in Texas without fellowship. And it is so wonderful to come to God's feast and to be able to fellowship eyeball to eyeball and to hug each other and to shake hands and to enjoy each other's company and speaking with one another, literally, and being able to look into your eyes. And it's just something we miss. The anonymity of the internet has allowed people to say things they would never have dreamed saying face to face. They are rude and crude and hateful. We have the greatest means of communication in the world, in the history of the world, yet people are more unable to communicate with each other than ever before. It's kind of like the saying, we're overfed and undernourished. The children aren't being taken care of, our children in society. The elderly in our society aren't being taken care of. Our society seems to be on a factory line of daycare to rest home. If you're a little child, you're put into a daycare center. If you're old and decrepit, you're put into a rest home. In the millennium, in God's kingdom, the children will be taken care of by their mother, not shuffled off to some daycare. And the elderly will be taken care of as well by family. And they won't be decrepit and sickly as they are today. We have a job ahead of us in teaching people how to live, how to manage their day-to-day life, how to get along with each other, how to be productive and happy. You remember the little boy that asked me, is it going to always be like this at your home? When Israel comes back from captivity, after what they've suffered, and we read about that in Matthew, it's going to be a time like no other time in the history of the world for 3.5 years. They're going to be teachable. We're going to be given a rod of iron, but we're not going to have to use it, I don't think, very much. Because those people are going to be broken. And they're going to ask you, is it going to be like this every day in your kingdom? And you're going to say no, because tomorrow is going to be better. Next week is going to be better. Next month is going to be better. Next year is going to be better. For 1,000 years, it's going to be like that. Our job is to teach. The world's population is going to be greatly reduced. We won't be teaching billions of people at the beginning of the millennium. The things that make up today's world will be present in the millennium, as well as science, agriculture, economics. But it'll have to be done God's way. And we have to learn that, brethren, so we can teach it. Develop the attitude now of doing things God's way. That's what we have to do. And we have to be teachers. We heard that last night in the first sermon. In Matthew chapter 28 and verse 19, in Matthew chapter 28, beginning in verse 19, therefore, go and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. That is what we will actually be doing in the millennium. Finally teaching all nations God's way of life, starting with Israel. And Israel will desire it. In Hosea chapter 3, beginning in verse 5. In Hosea chapter 3, beginning in verse 5, afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Eternal their God and David their king, and fear the Eternal and His goodness in the latter days. When they return, they're not going to be the same haughty people that we see out there in society today. They will have been broken. They will need us. I don't think we'll have to use very much of the rod of iron. Again, brethren, we have to get it right ourselves in order that we might teach it. In a sermon by Mr. Armstrong in 1982 titled, Why Only a Few Chosen Now? He stated, now Jesus taught them so that they could become teachers. He didn't start a church with a lot of members. He only started with a few students that they could become teachers. Then he could start the church around them, and they would be the foundation of the church. They would be the teachers. He didn't call members of the church at all. He called students, and they weren't members of the church. They were taught so they could become teachers. And when he started the church, he had teachers already there. The teachers were the apostles. He taught them, and when he had finished teaching them, he now had some people taught to become teachers. Brethren, we are learning to be teachers now. But this doesn't mean to accost everyone on the street we meet with a sermonette. It's not time yet. When Mr. Armstrong traveled the world, meeting world leaders and actually preaching the gospel, Mr. Armstrong did not tell world leaders or anyone in the world to give their heart to the Lord, or did they know the Lord. He talked to them in a way they could understand, and he wouldn't go around preaching to everyone he met, and we shouldn't either. I know of a minister in God's church that at Christmas he was checking out at a grocery store, and the woman, as they normally do, they say Merry Christmas at the checkout lane, and he proceeded to give her a 5-minute sermonette about Christmas. He called it witnessing for Christ. I don't think it convinced her. Is this how we ought to behave ourselves? Do you think that woman went home and told her family how wonderful it was to know the truth she had been taught that day? We're learning now to be teachers, but our time will come in the future. And that is the time we are observing this week at the Feast of Tabernacles. In Isaiah chapter 30, beginning in verse 20. In Isaiah chapter 30, beginning in verse 20, we read, "And though the Eternal give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not your teachers be removed into a corner anymore, but your eyes shall see your teachers, and your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk you in it. And when you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left." And you're not going to have to use that rod of iron, I don't believe, and say, get over there, get over here. I think all you'll have to do is say, that's not the way to do it. And we need to understand what we're teaching. My daughter was in school a few years ago, and in Texas they brought the new math out that no one understood. There in Texas, the school system admitted that students didn't understand it, the parents didn't get it, and the teachers didn't get it. But here it is. So what did they do? They went ahead and taught it, but it was under the instruction that everybody's going to pass. So everyone passed that year, their math course, whether they were able to pass the math course or not. They didn't understand. The teachers didn't understand what they were trying to teach. Brethren, can we teach what we have spent years learning? Can we teach God's law when the time comes? So many of our fellow brethren are being taught error today in other groups. How can they teach God's law if they aren't living under them today? We're very familiar with the scripture that read in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 6. And in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 6, "And has made us kings and priests to God and His Father, to Him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen." And over in chapter 19, in verse 16, we read, Revelation 19, verse 16, "And He has on His garment and on His thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." We are those kings that Christ will be head of as King of Kings. Not worldly kings it's speaking of. They have been deposed by this time and no longer holding any power in the world. I don't know if any of you realize that those are from Ephraim or from England, that the Queen and the royal family would be bowing down to you. None of us that I know of were born into royalty. But all of us were baptized into royalty. And we have to be trained to be a king. It's not something that comes naturally to us. Even those born into this world have to be taught how to be a king. Prince Charles had to be, and Prince William, for two examples, they've had to be taught. It is much more than wearing a crown of gold and jewels. In the Good News of May of 1980, in an article titled, "Yes, You Born to Be a King." When you repented and were baptized and God's ministers laid hands on you, you received God's gift of the Holy Spirit. You begin a training program that will culminate in you becoming a joint ruler with Jesus Christ of the universe. That's a job we really can't wrap our minds around, brethren, but it's true. But every day of our lives since we were baptized has been in preparation for this ultimate job. Now to be learning to be a leader, to be a king, to be a priest. I knew a man in the church that when he would go to the feast, he would have to get permission from the Defense Department. He was a rocket scientist. And he would have to get permission from the government to go to the feast. But I don't think any of us have that type of a job where we have to get permission. Some of us don't have those great of a job. Some of us are clerks. Some of us are waiters and repairmen. Some of us are barbers, perhaps, hairstylists, dentists, janitors. Some of us are construction, architects, whatever. But we can still learn what we need to in these jobs. We can learn something from it. And, of course, God expects us to. I think I've learned a great deal as being spent 16 years working for the state of Texas as a trooper. I've learned what God, I think, a few things that God wanted me to learn. Unfortunately, I wish some of them I hadn't. But every day we are learning to make wise decisions and how to deal with people. In some cases, very irritating people. Learning a proper work ethic. How to get things done. And a lot of times we are learning how not to do something. That's probably where we learn the most. The world has a name for it, the school of hard knocks. We see a very good example of that with King David. Samuel anointed David king of Israel. He didn't place a crown on his head, give him fine robes and jewels on his body, and haul him off to the palace and set him on the throne. No. Before he was anointed king, he grew up tending sheep. And probably after he was anointed king of Israel, he went back to shepherding the sheep, because sheep are kind of like people in a lot of ways. It was around 15 years later that David finally ascended to the throne. And David had endured quite a lot before that. A vast amount of human experience. David wasn't spent all those years waiting, being waited on hand and foot. He was a servant. He got very upset when his men risked their lives to just bring him a drink of water, remember, from a brook. So undoubtedly, he was a pretty good leader. And Moses spent 40 years tending sheep. Before that, he was trained at Pharaoh's palace as a prince and a general of Egypt. People in the world might think that training as a general was probably the best training anyone could have to be a leader. But apparently God didn't think so, because Moses spent the same amount of time tending sheep, 40 years. In the article of the Good News of May in 1980, again, yes, you're born to be a king. We dare not drift with the rest of this purposeless, confused world. We have a rendezvous with destiny. We were born to be kings who will be servants of the people they rule. Matthew 20 and verse 25. And in a verse we're quite familiar with, Matthew chapter 20, verse 25, but Jesus called them and said, "You know that the rulers of the nations exercise dominion over them, and they who are great exercise authority over them. However, it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to be great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be chief among you, let him be your servant." Brethren, how do we conduct ourselves in public? Have we ever done things that reflect badly on the church? How about our dress and decorum? In preparation to be a king, one must be conscious of the importance of, firstly, character, secondly, conduct, but also those things we might not always pay close attention to as future kings: dress, grooming, etiquette, and proper decorum. There is a style of dress for every occasion, and we're not expected to wear a coat and tie and polished shoes to a picnic or the beach, just like you don't take a grand piano to the camp out, and you don't get a country western band up here to play hymns. There's a place for everything. Neither are women expected to wear dresses and heels on such outings. I experienced that. My company I worked for, I worked for one of the largest companies in the world when I left the troopers. And we used to have what they call casual Friday. You could dress casually on Fridays. And I got the dressing down a little too much. And my boss came in to me one day, and one Friday, and he says, "Are you here to run your department or drive a truck?" And I straightened myself up, and I began to dress properly then. I remember in the 50s, at the Feast of Tabernacles in Big Sandy, that Mr. Armstrong had to get on the men at the Feast of Tabernacles because they were coming to services unshaven and unkempt. They deemed themselves on vacation and not a commanded assembly of God. They were dressing down a little bit too much, and Mr. Armstrong corrected that. We still have to live in this world, yet not be a part of it. But it is still sometimes very difficult not to fall into bad habits and start dressing and acting like the world, just like I was on, you know, casual Fridays. If you want to know just how bad people are dressing now, just Google Walmart people and spend a few minutes there. I will say this for Ephraim. I was in England for the feast in 1982, I believe. And I've seen men digging ditches and wearing a coat and tie. It's just amazing to me. And I have gotten into the habit now of asking my wife how I look sometimes before I go out, because I have this tendency to want to dress down. And I want to know if I'm presentable enough to go into public. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 2, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 2, do you not know that the saints shall judge the world? And if the world shall be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? During the times of the Old Testament, there was a distinction between kings and priests. King Saul made a terrible mistake, remember, brethren, when he took upon himself to offer a burnt offering when Samuel didn't show up when he expected. That wasn't Saul's department. That story is in 1 Samuel 13. We won't turn there. However, at baptism, we became heirs, along with Christ, to be both kings and priests. It doesn't say kings or priests, but kings and priests. And in 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 9, and in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, we read, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood." So royal denotes being a king, and of course the priesthood. The kings rule the land, but the priests who instructed the people in righteousness. And the last few scriptures here we'll go into. Malachi chapter 2 and verse 7. Now remember, brethren, you're going to be kings and priests. And in Malachi chapter 2 and verse 7, "For the priest's lips should guard knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth. For he is the messenger of the Eternal of hosts." And in Ezekiel chapter 44 and verse 23. And in Ezekiel chapter 44 and verse 23 we read, "And they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and profane, and cause them to discern between the clean and the unclean." Brethren, we have to learn that now. Again, we have to learn to live God's way now. We must get it right in order to teach it right.